There should not be a stigma for leaving patient care. That I'm a physical therapist who originally was out there treating clinically like everybody else. And when it came to the point, which was pretty quickly in my career, that I realized I wanted to do something else, I sort of had a decision to make. Do I try to do something clinical and maybe more entrepreneurial, or do I go a completely different direction? And I just knew I didn't love patient care. I see us reaching out and fixing some of healthcare's biggest problems.
This is Maestro on the Mic,
a podcast designed to help you change your mindset and your life.
It is time for something new.
Join host Dr. Shante Cofield, also known as the Movement Maestro, on a journey to see the bigger picture.
Open your eyes.
Find your passion.
And discover how movement unites us all.
Let's get it popping.
This is Maestro on the Mic. I'm the Maestro, and you're about to get maestrified.
3, 2, 1.
Hey guys, Maestro here, coming at you live with another episode of Maestro on the Mic. Today I have with me someone who decided to take the road less traveled and now wants to help you guys join her on that wild ride. She's still a PT, was a PT, will always be a PT, but decided that the non-clinical path was her path, and she has since created a whole entire platform dedicated to that and dedicated to helping others who are kind of like, you know what, I want to leave that traditional clinical model. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Meredith Gaston.
Thank you so much.
How are you doing, homie?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you?
Life is good. We live in that 4-hour work week, so life is good. That means that you work actually like 80 hours for yourself, but we'll just say it's...
Yeah. Sounds better to say 4 hours.
So, Ms. Meredith, why don't you do me a solid and tell the people who you are and about this awesome platform, awesome website, resource is the word I'm looking for, resource that you have created.
Sure. So my name is Meredith Gaston, and as Shante said, I'm a physical therapist who originally was out there treating clinically like everybody else. And when it came to the point, which was pretty quickly in my career, that I realized I wanted to do something else, I sort of had a decision to make. Do I try to do something clinical and maybe more entrepreneurial, or do I go a completely different direction? And I just knew I didn't love patient care. So I ended up going a completely different direction, became a writer, and then kind of went on from there, became head of content for a staffing company, healthcare staffing company, and then moved on and went on to become a freelance content writer. And then I launched the non-clinical PT about a year and some change ago. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
The dream. And what exactly is it?
Sure. It's a website. I would call it a career development platform, I guess.
Ooh,
but I know. Been working on how to describe it in, you know, the elevator pitch.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's basically a platform. I aim to serve everybody with it. So I don't want to say, okay, I only provide courses, so that's all you get from the site, or I only provide free content, or I only spotlight people. So what I aim to do is help physical, occupational, and speech language pathology professionals and help them have one single resource that they can go to no matter where they are in their career, whether they're just kind of thinking, oh, maybe I want to go non-clinical one day, or if they're saying, I am so burned out, or I'm injured, or whatever happens, I need to get out right now. I want there to be a resource for them. So I have everything from a non-clinical spotlight series to all sorts of informational interviews. Well, that's pretty much what the spotlight series is, but informative articles also. So things like how to become a utilization reviewer, how to become a content writer, how to become a clinical educator, that type of thing. And then I have my course, which is for people who want to go through and have their hand held during the entire process. And so it's kind of, oh, I don't know what I want to do with my career. Or I have an idea that I might want to go one of these three directions, but I'm not sure what. So that course just kind of walks you through and holds your hand through the entire process. Then I have a couple of Facebook groups where people can go and network it with each other. And then I've got one where you can find jobs. I post 3 non-clinical jobs per day or more.
What?
And it's completely free to join. And it's got, right now it's got like 5,700 members, and it's just growing very quickly.
Back it up. Juan, how do you find three of these jobs every day to be posting?
Well, it's that four-hour work week that turns into like 80 hours. But I do a lot of this stuff. Like I was saying, I do it because I want people to have access to the jobs. And I know that not everybody knows how to search for them. So through my experiences with building the platform and building my course and coaching people, oh, that's the last thing I do. I coach people who've gone through the course if they want to keep going and kind of dive deeper. But through all of this, I've learned which of the websites are the best for everything. So I know that you want to go to Chronicle Vita or Higher Ed for these education jobs. And that includes not just professor jobs, but the ACCE and the CCCE and all those different jobs. They list them all on these platforms. So I go and I hunt and prowl through all these different platforms, kind of for my own edification too. But then when I find good jobs, I just put them in a queue and I share the best ones with the people who've gone through my course. And then I share the rest of them, which are still pretty phenomenal jobs. I share the rest of them on this job seekers group.
Jesus. All right. Two questions. One,
sure.
Give the people, because I'm sure people are listening like, what the fuck is the website then? I need to go to this right now. How do people go to this thing? Where is it?
Okay. So if you want to go to find those Facebook groups that I was just talking about, go to the nonclinical PT, www.thenonclinicalpt, no dashes or anything, .com/resources. And I'm going to be fixing up the page so it looks a little prettier soon. But if you scroll down a bit, you'll find both of those Facebook groups just linked directly. You can also just go to Facebook and put in the nonclinical PT and it should pop up with the main page, which then has the groups linked to it. And
dang.
Yeah, so that's how you find those guys. Okay. And then if you want to just go for the Spotlight series, I can send you all of these so you can put them in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll put
them in
the show notes for sure.
But there's a full, there's a whole series of Spotlights at this point. It's probably up to close to 50 by now. And so nearly every week I spotlight a new non-clinical rehab professional. So it'll be a PTOT, assistant, speechy, just someone who gets in touch and wants to be featured. Or more frequently, I reach out to people when I see that their career looks really interesting. So you get all sorts of people. You get salespeople, you get medical device reps, clinical trainers, clinical educators, that's another name for it, utilization reviewers, writers, just like the sky's the limit with that. And that's my favorite part, is just featuring people and learning more.
And that's on the website. Where was that, Meredith?
Yeah, that's let me actually pull up a direct link. It's pretty easy. It's okay, it's thenonclinicalpt.com/category/non-clinical-spotlights. That's not easy.
57 dashes. But she's going to send me the link, and then I am going to put it in the show notes for you guys. I know that some of you can't see the show notes directly from your players, but some of you can because you reach out to me and tell me, which is freaking awesome. But if you go to my website, all the show notes are on there. So you have multiple options of how to get this. And you can obviously just go to the nonclinicalpt.com and everything is going to be there in some iteration. You just got to click around. So you can figure this out, guys. I trust you. I have faith. Meredith and I were just talking about that before we hopped on here, that, you know, the importance of a candidate demonstrating their willingness to work and their readiness to work and their ability to do things and search for things themselves, as opposed to just blindly reaching out to someone like Meredith or myself and just saying, basically, give me X or give me Y.
Yes. Taking initiative is how I like to say. Just someone who takes a little bit of initiative and does a little bit of research first and then says, oh, okay, I've looked into this and I'm thinking this or this. What do you think? Versus, what do you know about this? Send. And then you're like, oh my gosh, that's such an open-ended question. It'll take me 3 years to write the answer.
Like, I know everything. That's why I started the website.
All-knowing Oracle.
This is amazing. So I had two questions. The first question was where they can find this stuff, which is thenonclinicalpt.com/resources. Mm-hmm. You can go on Facebook. Facebook group is on. If you scroll down, she said it's on there, but you can actually just go on Facebook and look. But I'll link everything in the show notes. But the second question is, what exactly are these non-clinical jobs? Like, could you give us some examples or, you know, things that are super common you see or whatever?
Sure. Well, it's funny because there are some that are more common than others, and I can go through some of those ones. And then there are ones that are more uncommon at this point, but they're the ones where I feel like we really need to be going as rehab professionals, because I don't see what I'm doing necessarily so much as, oh, solopreneur business. It's that's kind of what I do. But what I really see it as this, I can't say, you know,
what I'm saying.
a big vision of where I see our profession going on the whole. And I see us reaching out and fixing some of healthcare's biggest problems. So some of the paths that you can take are more in that vein. And I like to spend a little more time on those ones because those are where I feel like we should go. So I'll start with the more common ones and just kind of briefly say what they are. But one of them is utilization reviewer. It's a really big growing one right now. A lot of people think of it as going to the dark side because it's basically going to the insurance side of things. And you're doing clinical reviews. So you're looking at people's notes and saying, is this type of care appropriate? Are they abusing the members' benefits? Are they giving out just that cookie cutter 3 times a week, 12 weeks type of care? Or are they actually giving care based on what this patient needs? And so you can be in kind of a pre-authorization role, or you can be in a denials role, which is like a little more depressing probably. Yeah. But then you have the, yeah, it's interesting though, because I know people in all of these roles and they're, the ones in denials are very happy with their role because they feel like they are representing the appropriate use of people's benefits, which, I mean, you can, we were talking about this a little bit too. PTs are not above taking advantage of people's benefits. Mm-hmm. It's been known to happen. It would be like BS for us to say that it doesn't happen. So it's an interesting role for people. I like to say that people who are good rule followers and people who are by the books and who are really interested in keeping up with evidence do well in these roles, because that's what you need to do, is you need to know what the evidence says about different treatment modalities and what's working and what isn't working, and know whether the appropriate treatments are being delivered. And you and I know we kind of touched on this before the show. There, pretty much anything can work for a patient if you tap on what's right for that patient. So it's not like someone's just going to deny someone for using a modality that isn't traditionally used. It's if you use it for like 10 weeks and it's not working. Yeah. And then you don't try anything else. Exactly. The patient's coming in and they're like, I still got an 8 out of 10. And they're like, okay, well, here's another round of ultrasound. Yeah. You're going to get denied. But if you're using a little bit of ultrasound here or there, because the patient is getting better with movement and activity, but they also have this idea that ultrasound's going to help them, it's not like you're going to get denied for that. And so it's going to depend on the insurance company, but they're reasonable people. I'm friends with a lot of them through my work on the site. So that's one way. Utilization reviewer. I promised a small description, and of course I rambled.
Keep going. It's good.
Clinical liaison is one that, this is actually my first non-clinical job. When I first left patient care and I was doing my writing, then I, at the same time, was working as a PRN rehab liaison. And this is a great role for people who've worked in inpatient rehab or acute care, because you can take all that experience and then go work for an inpatient rehab hospital. And you can have any number of roles. My role kind of combined all of these things, but some of the larger facilities will split them into two separate roles. So you have the admissions liaison side, where you're sort of looking at candidates who come in from an insurance perspective. You're looking at things like, do we have enough beds available to take this person? Do we need to fill the beds? How's our medical director looking? Is she overloaded? Does she have too many patients? Or can she take on another case? That kind of thing. Then you have the rehab liaison side, which tends to be more kind of sales or marketing. And that was the side that I spent more time on just because of logistics at our job. And I never thought of myself as a salesperson, but boy, is it easy to sell something you believe in, because that's all you're doing. You go out and you say, we've got this damn good rehab facility. We've got these highly trained, highly skilled therapists. And in our case, no one had heard of the facility. In fact, the facility was kind of nestled in this larger hospital that had kind of a crummy rating. Mm. So I took it as a challenge to be like, I know the name of the larger facility does not have the best reputation in the community. And I had to admit that. You have to admit
that's it. That's right.
But the actual facility that I was representing was awesome. It was so awesome. And so I had friends who worked there as therapists, and they were some of the best therapists I know. So I would just say that. I would say I worked alongside this OT when we worked at our old job and this and that. And selling a facility you believe in is super easy. So that's my best advice for that, is if you apply for one of those jobs, just make sure that you believe in the facility that you're trying to sell. Because if you don't believe in it as a therapist, you probably have enough integrity that it's going to be really challenging to sell it if you don't believe in it.
Yeah.
So those are the two most common ones as far as really easy to transition in. You don't need any extra coursework. You don't really need to do anything else. You have to change your resume to be non-clinical, and you have to highlight the right keywords, but you really don't have to get additional experience or skills. So then you move into the ones where you do need a little bit more experience, a little bit more skills. And this is the one that I really, really like chatting about. It's called clinical informatics specialist. You can also call it a clinical informaticist, or And there are all these different offshoots that are sort of related that we probably don't want to get into too much, but you know, quality assurance is kind of in that same vein, and process improvement and things like that. But the long and short of it is you're trying to take our, excuse my language, our fucked up EMR right. systems and make them less fucked up. You're trying to get them, you're just trying to get the flow to be what we were promised back in the day that all this was coming about. And everyone was like, EHRs mm-hmm. are going to be the way of the future. It's going to be so much easier. And then we're like, no, it's not. It's terrible. Yeah. But you're taking it and making it awesome. And so I know a lot of therapists who've gone that route, and they freaking love it. It's, you're basically liaising between the clinical staff. So it'll be nurses, therapists, doctors, PAs, everybody. And you're liaising between those people and the IT people. And it just reminds me of that scene in Office Space. I know I'm totally aging myself.
People know what that is. They know what that is. Don't you worry.
They know what it is. Okay, cool. Well, it's that scene where there's that guy who's like, I'm a liaison. I'm good with people. But we actually are. We rehab professionals, we're actually good with people, unlike that Pet Rock guy who is not good with people. And so Tom or whatever his name is. But that's what you're doing in those roles. And so the only thing you really need for those is documented evidence of having done that at some point. And so we've all done that. We've all worked at some point or another with the IT person when what we're doing isn't working well. But you have to kind of step it up a little bit on the job and get a little bit more experience. So if everything is not working with your processes and everybody's staying late to document unpaid and things are a hot mess, that's your opportunity to step up and be like, okay, I'm going to be the task person, whatever, like the EMR czar of our rehab team. You start talking with the IT people, make friends with them, make nice. You're good at that. You're in rehab. Of course, you're going to be good at it. Make nice with them and start coming up with ways that they can help you improve your processes on a local level. And then when a job opens either in your facility, first of all, you'll be a shoo-in if it's in your facility. But if it's not in your facility, then you have that on your resume. You've got that to put on there. And then that's one of those jobs, like I was saying, you might want to get a little bit of extra certification or specialization for that, because you can take these certification courses online. There's one on Udemy, I believe. I can send it to you afterward. But you do not have to spend a fortune. But if you get a little bit of training, it will go a long way. And then if you work with Epic, you could always ask for your boss to send you to a little bit extra Epic training, because Epic is taking over the world. You've probably noticed. And they're the one that I see hiring a lot. And they're the ones who often like to see a little bit extra Epic training. But usually that Epic training is only possible if your employer pays to have you go. I need to look into that a little more deeply, but
what the heck is Epic? I'm like so removed from the world. I'm like, is that?
No, it's just one of the big EMRs. So it's like Cerner, Epic, Meditech, all those things. So, but Epic is the one that's taking over the hospital world. And so, from that perspective, that is where you would want to go. I would say, like, if you're working in the hospital world and you love tech and you love fixing problems, clinical informatics would be awesome. Yeah. And then you have all sorts of other ones too. Tell me to stop if you want to ask me questions.
Go ahead. Keep going. I don't know any of this stuff. You guys, listen, this is a very different like approach than, this is why I brought Meredith on. It's a different approach than things that I coach on, or things that kind of where people that reach out to me are looking to go into. It's still away from the clinical world, but down a route that I have clearly I got no idea about it. I don't even know what she was saying. I was like, Epic, all right, cool, sounds epic. So my goal in bringing people like Meredith on is to expose you guys to as many different resources as possible, because I have my listeners are very varied. So keep going, because we don't know what we don't know. So keep going.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you. Yeah, I would say the route that I initially took was writing. That one's a really interesting one. There are a few routes that are more, you really need to make more of a transition than a jump. The prior three that I mentioned, once you get the right background and you have the right job to apply for and all those fun things, then you can make the leap pretty easily, as long as you know how to package your application materials. But then when you're going for a different approach, so like if you're going to go into a writing role, you really have to take a completely different approach. Mm. And I remember you and I both wrote for the same publication, and that's how we met. And so when you first get started, a lot of times it's writing for free. It's writing for exposure. It's writing to build your portfolio. And then it just kind of clicks a couple of months in. And actually, that's a lie. It's however long in you're putting into it. It might be a couple of weeks, or it might be like a year or two, depending on how prolific you are with your writing and how how much you're taking initiative, to use our statement from earlier, but how much you're taking initiative to put yourself out there and build a portfolio and set up. You really need a special writing resume in this case, because it's just, yeah, that's a whole nother topic. But you really do need to do some special things with your writing resume. But it's more of a transitional career, and it's also a great side gig if you want to stay in clinical practice, but you just want to build your brand and you want to pull in some extra income. Writing is fantastic. So that's one. There's also, I'm always talking about recruiting, because we know a lot of people in recruiting. It's a high paying job. It can be very fulfilling. It can be very flexible. And it's just all the things that many of us are looking for when we're looking for a change from patient care, but you're still on the phone with people. You're still interacting with people, but it's hard to break into recruiting when you've been a therapist, because you don't know what they're looking for in these jobs, but it can also be super fulfilling. And I think it's really important for more of us to be in those recruiter roles, because we know what the candidate needs to be asking about sometimes more than the candidate does, especially if it's a newer grad. And so I find that a lot of people who have been former travelers find themselves in these candidate success roles that are more or less recruiter roles, just with a fancier name. And so their role is either to place candidates, or it's to help candidates be successful once they are in the roles. And so a lot of these growing staffing companies do have these types of roles open, but you have to be prepared to explain that you're comfortable with the nuances of the job. So managing a candidate pipeline. Well, we manage a caseload of patients. And then they're like, well, in an interview, they might go, well, but it's different because it's not as busy. You know, our recruiters are busy all day. And it's
tell me about it. Hold my drink.
Yeah, hold my drink. Exactly. Hold my beer. And so definitely, yeah. So a lot of this comes down to, and this is kind of getting on my soapbox though. And this is, to be honest, this is why I created the course, because I would have all these people who I would coach and counsel and work with and say, oh, we would land on this perfect career for them. And then they were like, well, what do I do next? How do I find these jobs? Where are these jobs? How do I get them? Where do I find the jobs? The websites you search for PT jobs are not always the ones where you're going to find the non-clinical jobs, at least not the ones you want. And then the competition is really high on Indeed. So even if you're used to looking on Indeed, yeah, that's cool, but you're going to be going up against all these other candidates. So your resume is going to get lost in the stack. But then it's your resume. We are so freaking spoiled as PTs that we turn in the worst resumes. I've seen some of the most abysmal resumes come through, but because they're clinical and because there's always a shortage, not in every city, not in San Diego, but there's a shortage in so many cities, people are like, oh, okay, this person looks good. They've got 6 years of experience and they've worked in these settings. Boom, here you go. But it's not like that with non-clinical jobs. You need to, for one thing, no spelling errors ever, ever, ever,
get
ever.
To proofread that shit. And come on.
I know, exactly. Get it's your friend to do it. I mean, yes. But also just knowing how to speak the language that isn't ours. And you and I have talked about this on other calls, but we're such bubble dwellers where all we know how to do, it seems, I don't want to include everybody in this, but many of us, fair PTs, all we know how to do is talk to other PTs and talk the PT language, but you are no longer in the land of talking PT language. So you have to break the habit of putting your resume and everything that you've read on, you know, NGPT and sites where we've written, kind of forget all of that, because you're not in that world anymore. You're now in the liaison world where you need to speak liaison terms and speak quotas. Yes, you've met quotas with your productivity, but it's no longer productivity now. It is a quota. It is a bed quota. And so you just need to know which terms to put into your resume and know how to analyze a job posting and take that job posting, literally analyze it, and then take it and put it into the terminology that it's going to get you through the computer to land the job. Because that's the other thing. All your resumes go through a computer. I hate to shit in anybody's Easter basket, but that's how every resume goes through this screening process. Unless this one very rare exception, if you're best friends with the hiring manager or something like that. But if you're, even if someone hooks you up, they're usually saying, okay, go apply to the job and then put my name in the space. And if your resume gets sifted out before it ever gets to the hiring manager's desk, it doesn't matter whose name is on there, because the resume didn't get through the computer. So yeah, the ATS, Google it. It's our best friend and our worst enemy. Applicant tracking system.
Shit.
But anyway, back to the whole recruiter thing. So you need to know how the applicant tracking system works from two angles, because you need to know how you would work with it as a recruiter, because that's going to be part of your job description. And then you need to know how it works to get the job in the first place. And so, again, that's the whole course thing, is just teaching you how to get your resume set up for that. How there's all this keyword software out there that you can use to analyze the job descriptions and then take it, put it into your resume, blah, blah, blah. But basically, in order to land these jobs, it is significantly harder unless you really have guidance, because you can't just put your clinical resume through and expect for them to go, oh, this candidate looks interesting, because they are never going to see it. They won't have the chance to say this candidate looks interesting if it just gets blocked out before it ever gets there. So that's recruiting. Okay. And then there are so many more. Just let me know if...
I do have a question, though.
Sure, sure.
What's the general, and I'm guessing it can be totally varied, is there a specific general demographic that you're seeing that's kind of like, you have 5,700 members, so that's like pretty big, but is there a specific demographic that's like, yeah, we see a lot of like people that are in their mid-40s that are, you know, what, or is it just like everyone and anyone?
It's so funny. I initially thought for sure, I was like convinced that was going to be my demographic. And as it turns out, I would say it's probably like 30 to 40% experienced therapists, but they're the ones who are the most timid and the most down on themselves about what they're capable of doing. And it's the people who are more newer, you know, newish grads who are composed.
Nobody listening actually knows that, so amazing on you. And
but now they know. Never use comprise for compose. It's no. Anyway. So, and I hate when I see it. It's such a pet peeve. But anyway, okay. So
everyone out there is just going to say, okay, we're going to say made up or make up. No one's even going to try and use either of those words. They're just scared.
They're going to be like, oh, she's so annoying. She's talking about grammar on this
thing. It's important.
But anyway, yeah, it is important. Yeah, especially if you're going the writer route. But, you know, in general, knowing how to use, well, you know, proper communication is what's going to land you. Being a good communicator is what's going to land you so many of these roles. So, but anyway, yeah. So as I was saying, like the less experienced PTs are the ones who tend to come in the most, because I think they see the most potential too. They grew up, so to speak, with Vision 2020 and with the APTA saying that we can do all these wonderful things with our degree. We can go into wellness. We can do this, that. And they've also seen their dreams become sort of crushed into a powdery dust and say, oh, well, I come out and I'm making like 55K a year and I've got like 200K in loans and this kind of sucks. And so those are the ones who are going, all right, well, we're millennials, we're optimistic. What else can we do? There's got to be something else we can do. This can't be it. And so interestingly enough, I would say that they are the vast majority of people who reach out. But then again, I've gotten people in there who've been out for like 30 years and they're going, I'm 60. I still love treating patients, but I just don't want to do it because it's hard on my body. Like I have one client who I coached who has rheumatoid arthritis, and she's like, I love it. I would do this forever, but I can't do it anymore. So we have to actually get, incidentally, a little more creative with the people who are more experienced, because a lot of times they're just so stuck in that way of thinking. Like I was saying before, you know, they're like, I don't know anything but clinical skills. I have no transferable skills, which is BS. But we have to do actual coaching. And that's why I have to get on the phone with these people a lot and be like, you can't think of yourself in this box, because otherwise you will stay stuck in your box. You're giving yourself limitations. It's not that the world is saying you can't do it. It's you saying that you can't do it. And so plenty of those people go into utilization review, though, because they've got so much experience behind them that these utilization review companies are like, oh, perfect.
This is totally career paths that I would never even think about. Like, you don't know what you don't know. And yeah, I love that, you know, I'm so just engrossed in the world right now and just like, just so deep into the world of like the cash-based model and kind of people that want to leave and go and do that. You know, they want to do stuff online. And like, that's my forte. That's what I do. So when I kind of hear about this other model, and I love the fact that this is another way that we're going to work on and reform the healthcare system.
Yes.
Like in my, you know, I'm the type of person that I'm like, oh, that shit's broken. I'm out. Like, I'm not even going to lie. I'm like, okay, it sucks to be you. Yes. I'm not taking insurance anyway. But this is amazing because, you know what? It's still around and it still exists. And the people still do take insurance. And there are plenty of clinicians out there that are still, that are doing hybrid models and that, you know, will continue to take insurance. And people that can't afford cash-based models, you know, as patients. And so, yeah, like this, we need to help them too. And I love that this is, you are providing a solution to a very, very real problem. Like, damn. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's a very, very real problem. And I appreciate, thank you for saying that. It's a very real problem. And the whole reason where this idea was brewing for like, I don't know how long now, probably 6 years. But when I burned out of patient care, it's so embarrassing because it was a second career for me anyway. And so here I was with this brand new DPT that was like way too expensive. And I didn't even enjoy PT school. Like everybody else said, oh, I loved school. What? I just, oh, the reality is kind of tough. No, yeah, I didn't enjoy either. School.
I was like,
this
is stupid. I don't want to be here.
Yeah.
Why am I in this? I don't want to learn about this shit. I did not enjoy it.
Yes.
No.
Oh, me neither. I hated it. And I, looking back, you know, I'm really glad I'm doing what I do now. I love it so much. But looking back, when I was 3 years out and burned out, I was like, what was I thinking going to PT school? I just clearly made the biggest mistake of my life, and I'm the biggest idiot. And talk about negative self-speak. I was very mean to myself during that time because there was like nothing out there to help. Because I was going crazy. I was sending out my non-clinical resume, which, oh, that's another thing we should touch on. You should not make just a generic non-clinical resume unless you have friends in high places or you network all the time. In which case, yeah, you should have a copy to hand out that kind of showcases your generic non-clinical skills and says a little bit about yourself and your summary. But if you're applying for actual jobs, you should always use a tailored resume. And I know it's a pain in the ass, and I know that people hate me for saying that, but I promise you, like, believe me on this. I promise, 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 you will start getting interviews if you start tailoring your resumes. But anyway, so what I was going to say is I was sending out these generic non-clinical resumes. Nobody was biting because I didn't realize what I was doing wrong. And it was the most depressing. It was just such a depressing time in my life because I was like, I even have all this. I was a graphic and web designer before I went to PT school. So I was like, all this graphic and web design. So, yeah. And so I had all these skills. Of course, they were super obsolete because I'm old, but they were obsolete, right? But I had them. I had these skills. And I could not land a job to save my life. And it was so freaking depressing. So I already was like, oh, I wish I could kind of help people in the position that I'm in. But I didn't know how to help them because I hadn't done it. And so it was only when I got out and I was successful as a writer that I was like, having people kind of reach out to me wanting help, and then started coaching them. And then at first I was doing free coaching, then it was paid coaching. And it was only at that point that I had the confidence to be like, this is something I could just do as my job, and people need this. And I love doing this. And that was sort of the moment where it all crystallized that this was my calling and everything. But I convinced myself when I didn't like patient care, because I tried like 5 settings by that point in just 3 years. I convinced myself that I just didn't like work. And I had friends and family, like well-meaning friends and family, that were like, maybe you just don't like working. Maybe you're just lazy. And I was like, I don't think I'm lazy because I really do enjoy being industrious.
Yeah.
I just hadn't found the thing that felt right.
You guys out there listening, that should resonate with some of you. Like two things there should resonate with you. One, she's giving you permission to not necessarily, you know, directly utilize your degree. And I did a podcast on this, I don't know, a million years ago. I don't even remember at this point, or a million episodes ago. But I think that it's really important. I do meet people as I go and teach and things like that, and, you know, on social media, and they're almost ashamed because you have a lot of friends that I guess they really like treating, or they're just telling you. Either way, you have a lot of people around you that are like, I love this. And you're like, fuck, this sucks. Like, I don't like treating. I've told people before, like, I love assessment. I don't enjoy treating. That's why I stopped doing it. And, you know, it's nice to hear other people be like, you don't have to treat. You don't have to use that degree. And you know, we go into so much debt, or at least I did. You go into so much debt to get this degree that you're kind of like, I think I have to like keep doing this to like prove to myself, I don't know, to prove something, even though we're like just going more and more into debt because you only make $1. So you're kind of like, I gotta hold on to this thing. So it's really nice to hear someone like you to be like, it's okay to do something different. And you are technically still utilizing that degree, especially the things she's saying, just going in a different direction. Like, that's okay.
Yeah. Well, and that was the whole idea behind it, because I think it stemmed from my embarrassment. And it's like amazing how much feeling embarrassed and ashamed can motivate you to do things in your life. But maybe that says something about my psyche, but we'll move on from that. But basically, but I was so ashamed of all of this that I was like, because people kept saying, oh, why don't you just go back to web design and graphic design? And I was like, but I don't want to. Right. I've worked so hard to get where I am. And I know there's got to be a way to combine the two. And luckily there was. But I think people feel like they have to scuttle away with their tails between their legs, like all ashamed if they decide that they don't want to treat patients. And I think that a lot of people who do go the cash-based direction might have a little bit of that in them because there's something that doesn't resonate in the traditional patient care model. And so in some cases, what I've seen at least, these are some of the people who come through, they've gone the cash-based way. They've enjoyed it, but they're like, the thing I like the least about my cash-based business is the treating part. Well, and I've incidentally spoken with a few of them. I'm not going to name them by name because one of them still has a business. So I don't want to like, you know, screw him over. But one I can think of just right now, he does consulting, he does teaching, he does all sorts of things in addition to the cash-based practice. And that's what he was saying when we chatted about it. He was like, I enjoy treating like 20% of the time. And so I think what a lot of people think when they build their cash-based practices is that they just are now switching to a cash-based model where you still have to work 40 hours in the clinic and make that your be-all and all like day job. And yeah, I mean, it might be the case, but you're also going to be doing a lot of marketing to get those patients. So if you think that life stops at 40 hours, no, you also have to do all the marketing. Stiff. So if you're already... Yes. So my feeling is if you're already doing the marketing, you're already doing these other things, and if you find that you like some of those things a little bit more, then why not focus on doing some of those and monetize some of those? And then you can, if you're a type 7 on the Enneagram like I am, we can get into that too. If you're a variety seeker, then that might scratch the itch a little bit better than working 60 hours a week. Running a fully cash-based clinic, and that's all you do.
Oh, makes sense. So makes total sense.
Yeah, lots of options.
What kind of advice would you give to people who are looking to transition or maybe just like dip a toe into a non-clinical job or non-clinical career? Because I mean, some people, and you kind of alluded to earlier, some people aren't like trying to fully leave yet, or maybe they can't fully leave yet. Like, what would you recommend?
First thing I would do is figure out what you want to do. And that's like the worst.
That's it?
The worst advice to just say. No, I promise I'm going to back that up. But as soon as it was coming out of my mouth, I was like, ugh. But no, but it's serious. You need to know what you need to do. But I promise you I'm going to give you some ways to do that. Start reaching out to people. First of all, start with the non-clinical spotlights because it's like ready-made for you. As I was saying before, those are informational interviews put in the format of articles. So start there, get your feet wet, explore what's going on. But then when you start seeing some things that you identify as, oh, this could appeal to me. Ooh, I kind of like the sound of her role. Then that's when you start finding additional people and reaching out to them and giving informational or requesting informational interviews. And I want to specify what an informational interview is. It is not an interview of like, hey, how'd you get there? And how can I get there too? It is, can you tell me about your job? Can you tell me about the daily responsibilities? Mm. Like, tell me a little bit about how you got there. Never does me come into the equation. It's like when you're selling something. It should never be like, I have this great thing that you can have. It should be, you get this from this product or service that I offer. And so it's the same idea when you're asking someone for their time and their help. You've got to be like, I'm curious about you. I'm curious about your role. I'm curious about your career. And selfishly speaking, from this side of the mic, I will say I love when people connect me to the interesting ones that they find. So if you're out there and you're doing informational interviews and you land on someone where you're like, oh my gosh, this person has the coolest career path and it's actually attainable. So, I mean, it's really cool that people go and work for ESPN. Super cool. But I don't want to necessarily feature those people on my site because it's not attainable for everybody. Yeah. I mean, it's attainable, but it's not something that can be... You know what I'm saying. So the people who have taken a path where you're like, that is a realistic use of my degree in a way that seems very attainable, being 40 years old or whatever, you know, not having your entire career ahead of you to just like set the world on fire. So please connect me with those people because I love to not burn those people out by having them get like thousands of people reaching out to them. I like to do my spotlights so that I can feature someone. They answer all the questions possible. And then people often ask questions on the article, and then they can just answer the question on the article versus them getting just bombarded with the same thing over and over and over. So it's just that whole streamlining your life thing. I'm trying to kind of streamline their lives. So if you find someone interesting, one, if you reach out and they don't get back to you, you can always connect to me, because a lot of times they're like, oh, I'll be featured on a website. Sure. So then they will get back to me. Or two, you know, if you have a great conversation with them, I would ask that you connect us, because I don't want to have them just start getting bombarded with people and stop wanting to talk about it. So I would say start by knowing what you want to do. Informational interviews are huge. Shadowing, volunteering. And then once you know what you want to do, oh, I also have a bunch of assessments in my course. That's another thing. I kind of referenced the Enneagram earlier. Mm-hmm. I love the Enneagram. I love the Myers-Briggs tests. I have a couple of customized assessments that I have in my course that are made specifically for rehab people. So it looks at your actual tasks that you've done as a clinician, and it has you sort of sort them in a way that illuminates, oh, this type of task really works well. I really like these. And, oh, I don't really like these tasks, but I'm pretty good at them. And you sort of get to rank them in a way that then links up with the career paths that we discuss later on in the course. So that is obviously my very sort of biased opinion is, of course, check out Non-Clinical 101. That's my course. I believe I have a link for you, Shantae, if you want to give that one out.
Oh, yeah, you did. But, that's right. I set that up. You're right.
Yeah, so I do have an affiliate link for Shantae. I would appreciate if you guys do ever take a look at the course that you go through that link, because she's awesome. She had me on the show. It's so nice. So just to show your thanks.
Appreciate
it. But basically, it's a four-step course. It takes you through the process of self-discovery. So everything we just kind of touched on briefly. And it's much more in-depth. And you do a lot of visualization. And then you go on to step two, which is exploring the different career paths out there. And some of them are ones that are better for people who've had kind of outpatient experience. Some are better for people with inpatient experience, as we kind of talked about, and it goes through all those. Then step three is getting your application materials ready, and that's the whole exploring where the jobs live that you want, how to find them, how to prep your resume, how to put them through the software that we were talking about, make sure that they're ATS compliant, yada yada. And then the last part is the interviewing and negotiation phase, and that is, incidentally, that's what some people have said has been the most surprisingly helpful for them, because we don't know how to negotiate for roles that we don't have much leverage for. Yeah. So if you're going into a new non-clinical role, it can be really scary to negotiate a salary. But there are some tactics in there to help you negotiate and get a better rate than you might be initially offered. So people have been really happy with that. Uh-huh. So yeah, that's where I would say start out through the self-discovery, and then, you know, work with the course if you want that guide, that hand-holding. But there's a ton of resources. There are a ton of resources, I should say, on my site. And don't be shy about reaching out and doing those informational interviews with people, because most of the people out there who have left patient care they're feeling a lot of emotion about it. And so a lot of times it's negative. It's a little bit of guilt. And so when you reach out and you say, I want to pick your brain. I'm curious. I'm really impressed by your career. It's like giving them a breath of fresh air to say, oh my gosh, what I did was actually really inspiring for someone, instead of saying, oh, I suck at clinical care, or I hate it, or I burned out, or I'm like emotionally weak, or all the other things we say about ourselves. Yeah, you're actually flattering them, and it's a refreshing change. And then there was one other thing I wanted to point out, and that is that I don't know how many people of your listeners are into the APTA. I have had mixed emotions about it over the years. So I understand if you're not a member, I understand if you are a member. But we are working, and this is fresh news. You're like one of the first people to hear this. But we are working, yeah, girl, to set up a catalyst. I want to say it carefully. It's a catalyst group within the Health Policy and Administration Special Interest Group in the APTA. So much like regular politics, I don't always understand APTA politics. But what that means is we've got this catalyst group, and we are setting everything up for non-clinical. It's called Beyond Clinical Practice. And it is specifically for non-clinical careers. So we now have the APTA on our side backing us. We're just waiting for everything to get set up officially on their website to make a real announcement and blitz it out everywhere on social. But hopefully by the time you release this podcast, that will be.
And what exactly happens within this? Explain me, please. Because I'm like, I'm confused. Yes. Like, are you working for things within the APTA? Or are they just posting? What's happening?
Yes. So our goals within the group, when you set up a catalyst group, it's kind of like a information gathering. It's like one of those when those candidates haven't announced that they're running, but you know they're going to run.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, so they're out there talking to people. And that's what the Catalyst Group is. Like, we're a little group. We're not necessarily running for president of like a special interest group or anything, not necessarily going to set that up, but we are gathering interest. And so I'm trying to encourage people who have maybe not been so supportive of the APTA for, believe me, understandable reasons. I have had my moments over the years and let my membership lapse for quite a while and then got back in. But if you're wanting the support of the APTA, we have to show them that we value this movement. And so we've already got a bunch of people who are supportive of it and are talking about it. But we need to just kind of move that past so that we can become an actual special interest group. And once you become a special interest group, that's like, you know, health policy and administration. And then you have aquatics and all these other things, women's health. I hope I'm not misstating some of them, but I'm going from memory.
They know what you mean.
Yeah.
They're actually trying to switch health. The women's health. And they actually saw Carrie Pagliano's thing that Instagram story today, and they're trying to change the name of it, and I was like, fuck yeah, because it's not just women's health.
Yeah, isn't it gonna be like pelvic
it's
health,
like Academy of Pelvic Health or something?
And I was good, like, which is about exactly time. Yeah,
dang,
because everybody's got pelvic problems.
I was like, it's so right? Like exclusive. So what ideally, if everything got passed, would this be?
So this is gonna be it's gonna be support. So basically, now I'm going from memory for our goals, but it's going to be support in a number of ways. So there's going to be mentorship within the APTA. Oh. So if you want to launch a career, So we self-appointed Aaron Hackett. He's an active APTA member and he's a utilization reviewer. So there's going to be support and mentorship from this actual Catalyst group, which we hope will grow into a special interest group eventually. But there will be support, mentorship, resources, and most importantly, this is what I'm really excited about, coursework that counts toward our license renewal as practitioners. So you could take a course on marketing and it would still count toward your CEUs, which
that
I think is really
so
important from a CASPE. Right? Yes.
People
because
fucking
of the CASPE.
Ask.
Yes.
Yeah, anyway, so like just help them out.
Yeah. And I'm going to be honest. I've gone to conferences. I don't want to like at the conferences. But I've been to conferences where every class you attend counts toward your CEUs. And there were some that were straight up marketing panels where I was just like, okay, so this is happening. Yeah. It's just not widely known. It's not like MedBridge has it. But these conferences are starting to worm in there with that. Oh, that's a wrong terminology. I love these people who run the conference. It's not worming in. It's just being forward thinking. They had sessions on telehealth. They had sessions on marketing. They had sessions on everything. And we need to know those skills to be successful as practitioners. Even if we stay in the insurance model, we sure as hell need those skills if we're going cash-based. And if you're going non-clinical, it's like, why on earth would you take clinical courses if you never intend to practice again, especially if you left because of an injury? And so when some people in certain states leave clinical practice, they are kind of like up a creek without a paddle because they are required to have anywhere from like 100 to 300 hours per year of patient care in order to maintain their license. And in California, I'm really lucky. So are you lucky? If we decide to never touch a patient again, all we have to do is take our MedBridge or our physicaltherapy.com courses, or I'm going to go to your course now that I know about it, and renew our licenses, and we can stay PTs forever. But if you're in Minnesota, for example, I know someone who runs a blog there, a super successful online business, and she's just getting to the point where it's time to renew her license. And she's like, I don't have the hours. What do I do? And she has to make a choice between like getting licensed in another state, which is technically illegal, or against our practice act. You're not supposed to get licensed in a neighboring state. Yeah.
In a neighboring state, but they can do like one that's not touching.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, that'd be such a good workaround. I love how your brain works. But yeah, so she was thinking about doing that. But the thing is, she was like, this is messed up because, you know, she runs this really successful, wonderful business. People love it. So why on earth should she have to choose between giving up her license and not? It doesn't make any sense. So that is the biggest thing. So I would say, like, in order of importance from my perspective, the number one priority would be to have those laws and rules, which are state specific, go away because they're silly. You should not have to clinically practice and keep your license. Now, if you do go back into the clinic, sure, there can be like a reentry course that's just kind of like a clinical refresher. Yeah. I understand if they want to require that if you've been out of the clinic for X amount of years. But I just think it's punishing, especially exactly. It's punishing to women or men who choose the to stay home with kids, like that kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. That really is.
Yeah, it's just
it really
silly.
Is. I think my audience is pretty progressive, and there's not anyone out there that's going to be like, but if there are people that are kind of like, but like you can be practicing straight through for that same time and still suck. So don't use that as like, but like it is what it is. Like no one's going to come in and then do some crazy shit and like be like, I'm doing surgery now in like, like take it easy. We're physical therapists and not to downplay what we do, but like, be nice to your patients, probably fucking get better. Like you're coming in and you're not going to like do dry needling all of a sudden with someone, like it's okay. I mean, I totally support this, that concept of, yeah, like if you want some time away and then you come back, you should still be there. You didn't forget.
Yes. And that's what I'm hoping to kind of work with them on, is set the parameters and say, all right, well, what is a safe amount of time to be away? I'm sure, you know, if someone just took a year or two off or even like 3 years off, they'd probably be fine. But personally, I've been out of the clinic now for, it's bordering on 4 or 5 years, but I'm just now getting to the point where I'm like, I don't remember things that I should remember. And so maybe it's 4 or 5 years. I don't know what it would be, but we would need to come together as a catalyst group and then eventually a special interest group and set these parameters and say, okay, so if someone's out for X amount of time, what course do they need to take and where can they find that course? And does it need to be hands-on? Can it be hands-off with the advent of telehealth? Yeah. Who knows? You know, probably can be online. But there are all these different things we need to figure out. And so that would be the number one priority, is like figuring that out and then having the right coursework accepted for CEUs, and then the networking, the support, the mentorship. And then I also really strongly feel that there should not be a stigma for leaving patient care, because too many people who are unhappy in patient care are staying there because they're too fucking afraid of what people are going to think if they leave. And if those people would just like pick their crap up from the floor and go in another direction, they would be so successful and they would be so helpful to the healthcare world if they would just get there. And so I want that stigma to just go away. I'm sick of people being like, oh, so you're not a PT anymore. I'm like so sick of hearing that. And I get it all the time. And one of the reasons I keep going to PT pub night and I keep going to school, like little reunions and things, even though I know that I'm going to have to explain my story ad nauseum, and I know everybody who's there is like super passionate about clinical care, so I'm going to feel dumb and I'm going to feel silly. I just keep going because I want to be like, just because I left actual patient-facing patient care does not mean I'm any less of a PT. It doesn't mean I care any less about our profession. And it does not mean that I want to be less of a part of our community. I want to show up to these events and I want to embrace. There are always two or three people who come up to me at the event and they're like, hey, can we talk afterward? It's like, why do we have to go
black market
kind of
here.
Scurry off? Yes. Why do we need to like scurry off to the corner and be all secretive? Just be like, I'm loud and proud, man. Yeah. Okay.
I like the soapbox. I appreciate the soapbox. And I think, you know, it gives people permission to do other things. Like I did another podcast about this, about how physical therapy is the best first career. I didn't say it's the only career, first, last, and only career. I said it's the best first career, giving people permission to change, because you gain so many soft skills as a therapist. And that's why, you know, kind of tying into what I said before, if people were to step away and then come back, like it's 99, you know, like, okay, I'll round it down for you guys. 90% of what we do is the soft skills. The rest of it can be like one of your specific skill set. But so much of it, especially with those really complex patients, is the soft skills. Do they trust you? Do they buy in? Mm-hmm. And because of that, this skill set that we gain, and you had said it earlier, it just transfers into so many other things. And you actually can become a fantastic marketer if you really believe in the thing, like you said, because PTs do have their kind of like, I don't like selling myself. And it's like, you know, whole mindset issue. But when you really believe in the thing, you become a fantastic marketer, because you can talk to people, you can relate to them, you can, you know, figure out what moves them. So.
Yes. And all those soft skills you're talking about, people don't realize how important they are. Like we've talked now about taking initiative 3 times, but people can never believe it, but I'm actually super, super shy and introverted when I first am in a group. And so when I first was a professional, I worked at kind of a desk job back when I was a web designer and everything. And I would occasionally have to pick up the phone and call people, and I would sweat and look at the phone for like 30 minutes before I picked it up and called somebody, because I was so terrified. And yes. And so And then I became a PT, and all of a sudden you're on the clock. You got to meet productivity, and you don't have time. You don't have time to not to be scared to talk to someone. You walk in, if you're in the hospital, you walk into their room and you immediately go into negotiation mode. Hey, can I get you to get out of bed? You know, you start. So that's another thing. It's like taking initiative, using resources wisely. That's another one that companies value so much. Just being able to take a limited amount of resources and not waste the crap out of them. We are so good at that as therapists. We're so good at negotiating. We are such expert negotiators. That's amazing. And we don't ever give ourselves credit for that. I was like the crappiest negotiator before I became a PT. So I even remember having this conversation with my parents when I was leaving patient care, and they're like, oh, you know, such a shame, such a waste that it didn't work out with PT. And I was like, I don't think I could be doing what I'm doing now at all if I hadn't been a PT. I mean, obviously I couldn't do what I'm doing right now as a PT without being a PT. But even when I went into writing and I became kind of a freelance writer, and I was going through these contract organizations, and I was working for Creative Circle and Aquent, I was always like super, I took so much initiative with reaching out to jobs, and I would always over deliver. And I was always like working the whole time I was on the clock when I would take a contract with an organization. And it just made me into this like super industrious, forthcoming, just I negotiating machine. So I don't know how to put it, but it just taught me all of these skills that I didn't have before I became a PT. And I can truly speak to that because I was in another career, became a PT, and then changed again. And I'm like a different person. People who knew me in my old life are always like, what the hell happened to you? You're like way more ambitious or whatever it is.
I have one more question for you. I'm looking at the time. I literally just looked at the computer. I'm like, oh, we have to wrap it up. But
oh yeah,
I do have one question for you. Tell me, and I feel like this is going to be a long answer, but tell me what you like about, and I can't even ever pronounce the word, the Enneagram stuff.
You
sound so passionate about it. So I've taken it. I'm a solid 5, a very like firm 5. What can you say about this? Learn us some stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So I love the Enneagram because I love the Myers-Briggs, which is let me just back up. I know you said the long answer. I will keep it as short as possible. But the Myers-Briggs, the MBTI one, is one that's like ENFP or ISTJ, all those different ones. And I like that one a lot, but there are so many different types that there's a lot of overlap. So you end up being like, yeah, I'm kind of identifying with this. But if you woke up the next day and took the test when you're feeling in a different mood, you might even score differently. Yeah. And so I love that one, but I like that one way less than I like the Enneagram. The Enneagram, it seems like you're always going to score the same way from what I've experienced with clients, from what I've experienced with myself, my family. And my sister's a career coach, and she said her favorite is the Enneagram too. Huh. So that means a lot coming from a career coach. But anyway, so it's 7 different types, and you take a series of different questions basically, and they're pretty easy to answer. It's like yes, no, or partly, and whatever you score at the end of those, you land into 9 different categories. And each of those 9 categories, I think I might have said 7 by mistake, it's 9, has so it has a wing on each direction. So if you're a 6, you could go to 5, or you could go to 7, and then if you're at 9, you could go to 8, or you could go up to 1. You would start over at 1. And your wings mean one thing. And then you also can, when you're healthy or unhealthy, sort of devolve into these other types of Enneagram numbers. So I'm probably not doing the best job of really delving into what it means, but it's fascinating. And there's a free version that I will send you afterward for the show notes for those who can view them. And it is so helpful in letting people determine who they really are. I would say, so you said you're a solid type 5. Like people normally, when they get their results, they're like, I am a solid type, whatever I am. I'm a solid type 7. It's the variety seeker. It's otherwise known as the enthusiast.
You can hear it.
You can probably tell from my personality. It's like, And then exactly. I know people who, they come out and they take the test. So if you're an individualist, for example, and like that's the one who's just like, I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to make my own way. I'm going to be my own person. You're going to have a very different desire from your career than someone who's, say, the helper. And a lot of therapists think they're going to score the helper, but what ends up happening is a lot of, and that's type two is the helper. A lot of them end up scoring number three, which is the achiever. And the reason that they hate going staying in patient care is because it's really, really hard to achieve and be recognized for your achievements as a therapist. You can achieve, you can get certifications, you can move up, you can get more and more information, more notches on your belt. But in the traditional insurance model, it's not like you're going to get more pay for those anymore. That's kind of like a thing of the past. You're usually not going to get recognition. It used to be that your picture went up on the wall or you got a blog written about you, but everything's consolidating so much with these like massive conglomerates. So it's not like your little mom and pop clinic's going to put you on the blog. You're just one of like 30, you know, 35 chain clinics. Yeah, nobody gives a crap that you got your, MDT certification. So anyway, that's basically what I've noticed from the Enneagram is that when you know what your Enneagram type is, you can really, really take that, what it means from an unhealthy level and a healthy level. I encourage you to really look at the healthy and unhealthy levels for each number. And then you can go, oh my gosh, this helps me understand that these are the key components I need in my career. And it might not help you say, okay, well, that means I need to be a clinical educator, or that means that I need to go and be a utilization reviewer. But it will tell you, okay, in order to be happy, I need variety. Or in order to be happy, I need privacy and security. Or I need to feel like I'm supporting the rules and following the rules. And those things you can then apply by understanding what the different career paths are. You can then understand, okay, well, needing to follow rules, being a reformer, you might do well in a compliance career where you're like making sure everybody's got their licenses and got their credentialing down. So yeah, that's kind of how I take it and run with it. There's so much more that I go into when we really geek out on this stuff, but Enneagram's probably my favorite, especially the one I'm going to send you is a free version where you don't have to enter your email address or anything to get your results.
That's the worst thing. You're like, I just want the fucking information. You're going to spam me after.
No, I'm going to be getting like 30 emails. Yeah, I'm like,
I just want one thing. All right. All right, Miss Meredith, before I let you go, I got one last question. I know that had said that was one question, but sure. I give all the guests the same last question. Is there anything that you would like to leave the people with?
Oh my goodness. Yes. My number one thing I would like for everyone to realize is that no matter where you go in your career or in your life, if you respect what means the most to you, you will be happy. It's when you try to be something else because you feel like you should that you will be unhappy. And I'm not saying just be like a selfish asshole and just go, oh, okay, well, I just want this and that. And so screw my wife and kids and nothing like that. But understand what your true life motivations are and what your true career motivations are and just respect it. Because if you need space and you need alone time, don't go into a super collaborative role. You're going to hate it. If you need to be collaborating with people, but you're like, oh, it sounds so sexy to be a data analyst, then you're going to be miserable too. So just really take the time to do that self-exploration. It's the most important part. It's the part you should spend the most time on, whether you stay clinical, whether you go cash-based, whether you go non-clinical. Just understand what makes you tick and what makes you unique, and you will bring so much more joy to everyone else around you and to yourself in your life and your career.
I love it. She's giving you the real talk. Dropping the mic there. I love it. It's so important, though. I love it. I got nothing to add to that. You gave us the website, your website for non-clinical PT. Is that the best way to contact you if they want to get in touch with you with any questions or what's okay? Cool.
Yes. So there is a contact form on there. I do check my Facebook messages, but I only do that about once a week just so I don't go down the social media rabbit hole for too long. So either of those, I get a lot of people reaching out. So just bear with me, be patient, but I will get back to you. So definitely through the contact form on the website, through the Facebook page, just know there's always a bit of a wait.
Listen, at the end of the day, the wait is fine. It's like people have hated their job for 20 years and they're like, I need to write it down. Like, one more week won't kill you, homie. She'll get back to you. Yes. She will absolutely get back to you.
Yes. I just don't want people to think that I'm like ignoring them. Sometimes it can be a couple of weeks when I get really behind, but I do everything I can to get back to you. And if for some reason I don't, it probably means your message got lost.
Another one.
So just, send another one.
I love it. Ms. Meredith, thank you. This was awesome. Like,
thank you.
Really, really, like, you don't know what you don't know. So it's been super informative on my end, just like to know that this resource exists. And I'm glad that the audience got to hear that this resource exists because, man, we're all in this together. So the more people we can help out, the better. It's awesome. Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute delight. I love chatting with you, and this just took it to the next level.
I love it. You guys listening, thank you. I know you could have been doing anything, and you chose to listen to us, and for that, I am extremely grateful. I'm going to drop all those links and such in the show notes, so definitely check them out. If you like today's episode, if you're picking up what we're putting down, please give me some stars, preferably 5. If you loved it, subscribe. It does help the people to find the podcast. I've explained this to you guys before. Okay, officially wrapping this up. Until next time, friends, Meredith and Maestro,